This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. Thursday, the 6th of September, 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Joyce Go here in the studio with me. Good morning,
good
Joyce.
Good morning, Melissa.
Well, stay with us all the way till 10 o'clock on the morning run, and we will catch you up on all the news that you need to know as you start your day. We've got lots of news and interviews coming your way, including the Breakfast Grill today on the show. Andrew Koo, the CEO of Malayan United Industries, or Mui Group. You're going to be speaking to Andrew later, Joyce?
Yes, Mui Group is it's been around for many, many years now.
So it has a lot of, different. So it's a big conglomerate.
Yes.
And it's got Laura Ashley is one of the brands under it. And the Crispy Chocolates as well.
Oh, yes. And Metrojaya.
Metrojaya, yeah. That's right.
And Andrew, his dad is Tan Sri Koo Kay Peng. Mm. And interestingly, Andrew left the group a couple of years ago and he just returned end of last year. So we'll be asking him what made him leave, why did he come back, and why his plans.
And this company has been making losses,
yeah,
right?
It
hasn't been doing
making.
So well. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's something to discuss with him. Maybe he can give us some insight into how he plans to turn the fortunes of Mui Group around. More on that at 8 o'clock on the Breakfast Grill. But let's take a quick look at what happened in news overnight while you were sleeping. A few hours ago, Facebook and Twitter's top executives testified before the U.S. Congress. And this is, I guess, in a hearing because lawmakers are claiming that the tech giants there are failing to combat what is seen to be continued foreign influence in U.S. politics.
Yeah, they're saying that, you know, they're focused on what the technology giants were doing to prevent a future election meddling. Mm-hmm. And Mel, for me, right, when I read this article, what stood out was that they warned the social networks that they could face new regulations.
Yep.
So it's no longer like a Wild West for the social media. That in quotes, that's what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah.
Regulation is on the cards now. So when we talk about the tech giants, we're talking about Facebook and Twitter and Google, of course. But Google didn't turn up.
I know. I got everybody wondering. Wow, I think it. Not sure whether what happened. They didn't come up with a statement yet, right?
No.
As to, yeah.
So there was an empty chair next to Facebook's COO Sheryl Sandberg came and faced U.S. lawmakers. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey as well came. But Google, there was an empty chair. And I have to tell you, the optics did not look good, Joyce. Analysts are saying that it was a bet on Google's part not to go because perhaps, you know, they were worried about what would have been inevitable questions of Google's plans for China.
Right.
So maybe Google decided not to come for fear of those types of questions would come up. But who knows? We're going to await the statement from Google to find out why they're not taking this issue seriously enough to send a senior executive. The other story on our radar is on Johnny Bobbitt. Do you remember the story of Johnny Bobbitt, Joyce, the Good Samaritan? We've been covering that on the Morning Run
quite
a bit.
Yes, yes. And so what latest news is that the money raised online, $400,000, all of that gone.
Yep. So Johnny Bobbitt, he became a viral sensation after he gave his last. So he was a homeless man. He gave his last $20 to this woman whose car had run out of petrol. And then she and her partner had set up this crowdfunding platform campaign to, to get money to help Bobby build a new life. And what then happened became a case of he said, she said, and we've been covering that quite a bit. So I think $400,000 missing now from this campaign. The accusations are that the couple used it as their personal bank account.
There should be check and balances. It's quite scary how someone can just start up a, you know, GoFundMe or this kind of like financing platform and get donations. And then there are no checks and balances to it. Who's watching them, you know,
the
to make sure.
Right?
Yeah, to make sure.
Well, 140,000 people donated to this GoFundMe campaign. And now GoFundMe is saying, well, if it is determined that the monies that were collected were misused, then each of the donors will get a reimbursement of, I believe, $1,000. But still, I mean, you know, I agree completely with you that there was it's open to abuse, right? Who's going to be
so
checking?
Open for leakages to happen? And look at what happened.
All right, we'll be back with more news and discussion after this, including how 1.4 billion adults around the world are not getting enough exercise. Are you one of them? Tell us after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 9 minutes past 6 o'clock on the morning run. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Go. That was Earth, Wind and Fire with September. A bit of an obvious choice given that it's the 6th of September this morning. Right, just before the song, we alluded to the fact that 1.4 billion adults are not getting enough exercise. That's not us talking. That is the World Health Organization. Apparently, according to a study by them, WHO, doctors are now warning that all these adults, 1.4 billion adults, are putting themselves at risk of heightened risk, that is, of deadly diseases by not getting enough exercise. In fact, they're saying that global activity levels are virtually unchanged in the past 2 decades.
Yeah, so they recommend that each adult do at least 150 minutes moderate intensity exercise, such as brisk walking, swimming, or gentle cycling.
Okay, chop. 150 week. Minutes a week, you said?
Yeah,
a
each week.
How many minutes a day is that? About 20 minutes, about, right? Yeah. 20 minutes a day.
Yeah, and if 75 minutes on a vigorous intensity activity per week. If okay. It's either 150 minutes moderate intensity or 75 minutes vigorous intensity per week.
Oh dear. Okay. Does that count exercising my thumbs by scrolling my Twitter feed? Because I think that's the most exercise that I get in a week. I have to say, okay, so it makes complete sense, right? So this is a really comprehensive study. 1.9 million people across 168 countries around the world. This is in 2006. And really, researchers have found that because I think we're enjoying a more comfortable sedentary lifestyle, the level of physical activity has not increased much in the past decades, 2 decades. And this is despite, you know, all, I guess, the level of education in the public, level of awareness. Now, we know why exercise is important to us. Why are we not doing it?
I know, I'm guilty of that. It's like every time I say, yeah, I should try and go and exercise. And I used to be quite active. And I don't know what
happened. What do you mean by active? As in you would make time out of your day to play sports?
At least once a
week. Go jogging, go running?
I'm a big fan of Pilates.
Okay,
so I'll spend some time to do that. Not sure what happened.
I think it's called life, Joyce. Life happened. That's what happened.
And even before I started working, I used to play tennis as well.
Quite often.
So it's just a lot of that. But coming back to this, I think they say about more than a quarter of the world's adults, is about 1.4 billion people, were insufficiently active.
Insufficiently active, yeah. Because a lot of us are desk-bound. We drive to work. You know, we no longer do the kind of strenuous physical activity that was needed before, I guess, all the comforts of modern conveniences. But the idea really is, I mean, the question really is, we know how important exercise is to our health. Why is it so difficult to prioritize exercising? We all have 24 hours in a day. We all have busy lives, modern lives. The idea is, the question is, why can't we prioritize?
Do you think it's because, as you said, life happens and then suddenly there's just so much to do for some people and we don't manage our time well enough? Mm-hmm. I don't know. And sometimes when you have time, when suddenly an hour creeps, I'm like, oh, you have an opening and you're like, oh, but I got to get this done first. Because we're so busy, right? You have this checklist to do. And somehow exercise is not on that list. But I do look up to people who actually, they put exercise at the top of the list. Like, I need to go exercise first before I do this.
Well, they kind of build it into their work or their day, their schedule for the day, right? So they, as much as you say, okay, I need to sleep how many hours, I need to have lunch at what time, I need to pick up my kids at what time, they actually build it into their work, into their daily schedule. So they go, okay, at this time, I will make sure that I get half an hour, whatever it be, of exercise in a day. So it becomes a daily routine, part of, you know, on the checklist, that you, things you need to do today.
That's right, yeah. And some people I find, they join a gym.
Yep.
And after a while, they kind of forget
to
go to the gym.
I am so guilty of that. I joined in January. I think I stopped going in February and then still kept paying for the rest of the year. So this is where I believe sometimes you have to make allowances because, you know, life takes precedence in some way. Life happens. At certain points in your life, you know, other things become priorities, right? But whether you have the discipline to come back to making exercising a priority.
Actually, that is the key word, discipline, right? Whether you have that to go exercise. I think last time when we were kids, it's a lot easier because we had like pendidikan jasmani. Remember that?
Well, and kids, you know, you didn't have to work for a living, right? Okay, so the other thing is also part of this research shows that it's moderate levels of activity as well. So, you know, even walking back and forth can be considered. So just your steps daily can be considered moderate intensity exercise. I have to say here, I've also failed miserably. My Fitbit is now just a watch. No longer a fitness tracker. It's just tracking time and how much time has passed. So perhaps if, you know, the design of, say, your office or your house makes it that you have to walk upstairs or up, you know, further, you park your car further away, make sure that, you know, you put your phone charging further away so you have to get up and pick up your phone when you need to. So I think those little things can make a difference.
True. Actually, I must say in our new office, we walk a lot more compared to
the pantry is very far.
Yes. Maybe there was a reason for that.
And then we offset the walking more by eating more at the pantry, which is not good. We're not encouraging that. Tell us how you prioritize exercising. As we all know, exercising is important. We'd love to hear from you. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we'll take a look at job shaming because a former TV actor was job shamed for working as a supermarket cashier. Do we look down on certain jobs? Joyce and I will discuss after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Foxygen there with San Francisco. 22 minutes past 6 o'clock on the 6th of September, Thursday. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Go for the Morning Run. And thank you for WhatsApping in, Grace. She sent us a picture of her exercise bike and she said that you must schedule exercise because that's what she experiences, even if it's just 15 minutes. And she listens to BFM and exercises in the morning as well. So get on that exercise bike and go for it. As you listen to the Morning Run, we will keep you company all the way till 10 o'clock. You don't need to cycle all the way till 10, but well, half an hour is all that you need daily, according to the World Health Organization. All right, there's another story caught our attention this morning. The Jeffrey Owens, the actor from The Cosby Show, formerly from The Cosby Show, he had to deal with some backlash because apparently photos of him working at as a cashier at this retail outlet, this supermarket, you would call it, called Trader Joe's in the US, they made their way online and they were mocked. I think netizens were mocking him for the so-called falling grace from a TV show actor to a supermarket cashier. And the question is, why do you think people were mocking him, Joyce?
Yeah, I mean, it is disappointing. And it's not just online, you know, it's also like media outlets, because I think Daily Mail had an article they published. And, you know, I had a headline from learning lines to serving the long line. I think that's just a really low blow. And is it, but, you know, it's coming from Daily Mail. It is sad. It makes one wonder, you know, whether or not. Because the job is a job. He's working to earn a living.
Correct, right?
Yeah.
So why is one job better than the other?
Yeah, they should respect that.
I guess I understand that the glamour and glitz and glamour of being a, you know, big TV, a star of a big TV show like The Cosby Show, you are probably, you know, a household name, right? So to go from that to working in a cash supermarket, netizens are making that seem as though he went from a position that was high up and then a fall to, say, a more manual labor. Look, it made me think a lot about where this concept or this you know, where job shaming comes from. And it's a lot like body shaming, right? I think nowadays we feel so identified by our work, right? So much part of our identity that where we work matters. What we do matters. I speak to young people all the time and they tell me, you know, they don't want to be working in a startup that no one knows. They want to have on their CV a brand name company. They want, you know, to be able to tell people, I work in this big multinational corporation, even though I'm a small fish in a big pond. You know what I mean? So I think that's where it stems from, Joyce.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that. When I first graduated, all that was on my mind was, I need to get into a big four. I need to get into a big four because I graduated from accounting, right? And it's always an accounting grad's dream to join a big four. And then now that I'm older, I look back and I'm like, actually, it didn't really matter, right? Big four or whatever firm, because it's at the end of the day, it's the working experience. Like you say, you speak to young people, they want to join a branded name company, not a no-name startup. And I'm thinking, what if that startup, the no-name startup, goes on and becomes a great, well-known a company later on, and you, that person would have been part of that team.
The pioneering team. Yeah. That was, I think, one of my realizations when I was speaking to people like Noel Lim, former Morning Run presenter, and Mira Sivasodi of the Bigger Picture show. You know, when we were celebrating our birthday, our 10th birthday a couple of days ago, Joyce, they were telling me about how when they were called up to interview at BFM, who knew what BFM was? BFM was nothing, right? It was this unknown quantity. And to take a job and to take a gamble into a company like BFM 10 years ago, before we even hit the airwaves, I think was a huge deal. I'm not sure whether I would have made the same. I mean, when Malik Ali called me and said, would you like to join BFM? I was already listening to BFM at that point in time. So you could hear it. You had a picture of what it is. But would you join a company that was completely an unknown quantity?
Yeah, you don't know what to expect.
Exactly.
And what to, like, if you were to join it, the culture or how that would have grown.
Yeah. Do you think parents put pressure on young people as well to be able to tell their friends, my son or daughter works in this multinational as opposed to works for some unknown startup?
Actually, yeah, Mel, that's a good point. I mean, I think Asian parents, we can be guilty of that. You know, you kind of sometimes shape that thought of, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? Doctor, lawyer,
that's,
you know?
That's right.
Huh? It's that kind of like that, you know, preconceived notion that you already put into your child's mind, which is actually, yeah, that's a good wake-up call for me.
But there's also the counter-argument to that is that maybe these big companies actually have a better working experience. So you get trained with the highest skills. Well, tell us what you think again. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899. Grace just replied and said BFM exercises her brain too. Thank you so much, Grace. All right, we'll be back with more news and analysis, but we've got the 6 o'clock news bulletin coming up next to take you there. Marvin Gaye with Can I Get a Witness? BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:41 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Joyce Goh here with me. If you've just joined us on the show, good morning. Welcome. That was Mysterious Ways by you two. Mr. Tan weighing in on WhatsApp. Loving the music choices this morning. I think we have a U2 fan on our hands. He's saying that he loves to hear U2 in the morning. Thank you for your text this morning, Mr. Tan. U2 can join the conversation at any point in time in the morning. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, one person who is, I think, quite mysterious, Joyce, in the way he's thinking and the choices that he's making, is the Education Minister, Dr. Yeah. Mazli Malik. I'm struggling to figure out the justifications for some of his policy choices, shall we come to say. So he has decided to accept the post of President of the International Islamic University, or IIUM, and that decision has drawn flak from both sides of the divide. So Barisan Nasional and Pakatan Harapan parties are urging him to reject his new appointment. I think civil society organizations as well, they all are stating a clear conflict of interest.
Yeah, Mel, I mean, for me, as a parent with young kids, you know, when he was first appointed, everyone was like, oh, okay, so much to expect from him. What's he going to do? How's he going to change the education system? Mm-hmm. We look forward to hear his plans. And then now this this news, right, as he's taking up this post, and everyone's wondering how will he be able to juggle? And as you say, you struggle to figure out what are his justifications for taking up this job.
Correct.
I mean, for me, it's the same. Like, does he have the time? Can he juggle all of this, you know, everything that he has? What's on his to-do list? And basically, you know, for me, is he wearing, which hat is he wearing first? The education minister's hat, or is he going to wear this hat with the university?
All right. So that, and therein lies the conflict of interest, right? So when, you know, as education minister, how will he take off the president of this, of IIUM hat off? And that's the biggest conflict. In fact, I believe, you know, making rounds on social media has been an excerpt from a speech that he made not too long ago. I think it was 2 months ago, the education minister, at that point, newly elected education minister, had said, and I quote him, "This is a new era. I will make sure that the Pakatan Harapan government will never misuse universities for political interests, and this includes me." So that was him, exact quote, verbatim. And I think that's what everyone's trying to say. Well, what exactly is your justification for taking this appointment? I believe his defenders have said that he is the best man for the job, given that he did come from this. This was his alma mater. He worked as a lecturer there and he knows the ins and outs of this university. Second justification that I've been hearing has been the fact that he's not going to be paid a salary for this. But is that enough, Joyce?
Yeah, for me, he does have the other job that he has.
The education minister yes. job. Yeah, that's just a small role, isn't it? Just fixing the education system of the country. Small matter. Small matter.
Well,
yeah, Mahathir couldn't do it. Well, actually, that's you know, Mahathir decided to set, sorry, Tun Dr. Mahathir decided to not take on the role because of the backlash of this dual role.
That's right. Remember, he said that, oh, because at first, yeah, Tun M was supposed to take it. And then there was this whole, everyone saying, how's he going to juggle the two? And he said, yeah, actually, I'm going to step back. I'm going to focus on being prime minister because, yeah, education ministry, I'm going to pass that on. And it's true. I mean, for us as well, you know, as it is one job. And we're not talking about being the education minister.
Yeah. You know? We are actually going to be talking about this further. And we will be speaking to Dr. Professor Dr. Faisal Sham Abdul Haris. He is an exco with GURA, which is the Movement for Education, and a UKM associate professor. And we're going to be discussing this with him after the 8:30 news. If you're interested, you can always download the podcast on RBFM app. All right, after this, we're going to come back and take a look at the backlash over the lesbian caning in Terengganu. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Good morning. It's 6:50 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run with Melissa and Joyce. That was Rodriguez with "This Is Not a Song, This Is an Outburst." Good one, I would say. Quite apt, I would have to say, for this next discussion we're having about the caning in Terengganu. So the Terengganu government has defended the state Sharia High Court's decision to hold a public caning of two women for lesbian sex. Now, the Menteri Besar of Terengganu, Dr. Ahmad Shamsuri Mokhtar, he says the outcry over the caning is only temporary and will eventually blow over. Will it?
Well, he said in quotes, you know, "We believe there are still some things that people have yet to understand about it, and in time, they will." And in another quote, "The society should look at the punishment more objectively and not be driven by emotions."
Right. So what they're saying is that critics should not make assumptions about witnessing the without witnessing the form of the caning, the way it was carried out, because they're arguing that the caning was different from, say, caning under the criminal justice system. That is harsher whipping, they say. But I don't know. I mean, judging on the backlash, I disagree with the Terengganu government. I don't think this is something that will blow over. And I think the role of the media is to make sure that it doesn't.
Yeah, so we spoke to Rosanna Issa, the executive director of Sisters in Islam. We asked her thoughts about the rationale for the punishment. And, you know, our Terengganu exco Satiful Bahari Mamat said that the intent was for the caning to be educational, not serve as a punishment. So what's her response to this statement?
I mean, you know, they keep saying this, you know, it's not intended to cause pain. They highlight, you know, the difference between, you know, the Sharia caning and the caning that's done under the penal code, that, you know, the difference is this is not intended to cause pain or harm the women. And really, it's in direct contradiction to the fact that, you know, there's a high degree of humiliation that they faced on Monday, because it really is an orchestrated spectacle. And it could have long-lasting psychological and emotional impact. Because let's not forget, the women were hounded by the media the moment they arrived at the Terengganu Sharia High Court. Leading up to the execution, you know, the news circulated on social media, with some parties calling on members of the public to come and attend and support the state action against the LGBT community. And there was also, you know, all various kinds of posters, which, you know, I had also received from various WhatsApp groups, you know, talking about, you know, let's do this, you know, let's support and witness this punishment that's going to take place today against the LGBT community. You know, it's kind of like an anti-LGBT solidarity. So punishments that are made in the name of Islam, this is what they claim. But ultimately, what we want to say is that it is time for us Muslims in Malaysia to reclaim Islam from being defined by these politicians who are pushing their political agendas. Because we cannot forget the fact that Quranic teachings emphasize repentance, forgiveness, and personal transformation. Because God, you know, is forgiving and merciful. This is what we are taught in the Quran. And the preservation of human dignity is a requirement in Islam, you know. So acts such as whipping, you know, has as its main motivation the humiliation and shaming of the guilty party. So why are these teachings not being used to inform the court's decision in terms of its sentencing and execution? And given that, you know, this was a first-time offense for both victims, and yet the court and the state of Terengganu saw fit to sentence them to the maximum 6 strokes of the cane and conduct it publicly on top of that. So that's our position.
The overall argument from people who support this punishment appears to be that it's permissible according to Islam, and therefore people who aren't members of Islam should not participate or don't have a stake in this conversation. Rosanna disagrees with this argument. Here's what she said.
You know, that is always the false argument that's given. You know, this is our issue and not your issue, so, you know, you don't have to bother about this. You know, we need to remind everyone of the fact that we are all citizens of a democratic nation state, and all of us are invested in the fate of our fellow citizens. You know, there are many issues in this country, and there are many issues as well in terms of, you know, this whole entire fiasco that we need to unpack. And chief among them is also the issue of access to justice, which is not a religious issue. It's a national issue. And given that, you know, the two women allegedly pleaded guilty, it is questionable, you know, if the whole thing about legal representation, again, if it was accessible to the women in court and even prior to that. Because if LGBT persons have limited access to justice and redress and legal presentation because of who they are and the preconceived notions of, you know, on the basis of religion, sexuality, and the LGBT persons, then I would say that, you know, we have a huge problem here, and it's upon all of us to actually address it. And for as long as Islam continues to be the source of law and public policy, then everyone in Malaysia has a right to talk about it.
That was Rosanna Issa, Executive Director of Sisters in Islam, and I completely agree with her. If we are going to use principles of a religion in public policy that affects all members of Malaysia, all citizens of Malaysia, then that should be a conversation that everyone should be able to have, right?
Yeah, and interesting points coming from Rosanna, and you can see how she says, you know, some people use the religion, they politicize it, as opposed to actually, yeah, what goes beyond the religion or actually practicing it.
You know, we were just talking a little bit earlier, Joyce, about people weighing in on the appointment of Dr. Mazli Malik, the education minister, as president of IIUM. So many people have weighed in on that decision, and yet you see the silence is palpable or deafening from certain quarters when it comes to this the caning of these two women. I don't know whether there has been an official statement made by the Ministry of Women, Family and Community Development, but I haven't seen one yet. I'm hoping they will issue. I'd like to hear what the Minister of Women has to say about this, as well as the Deputy Minister, so Dr. Wan Azizah, as well as, I believe, Hannah Yeo. So looking forward to hearing how they plan to protect women's rights from this in the future.
Good point, Mel. That's true. Looking at what's coming up from YB Maslik, the Education Minister, what's happening there, you contrast that to what's happening here. It's quite sad.
And I think there are legal jurisdictions at play here. So I'm not completely unaware of that, right? So the federal government has no sway over state Sharia state laws. They cannot tell the states how to change even certain laws within the Sharia that falls under Sharia within the state. And I completely understand that Sharia law is different, and that has and always will be Malaysia's conundrum. What happens when it comes to an overlap between civil law and Sharia law? And the government does not hold sway over Islamic laws. There's nothing that can be changed. The federal government, I might add. So that is something I think we need to ponder as Malaysians, that shouldn't everyone be held equal under the law? Something we will continue to grapple with, and not a conversation that will end overnight. But we would love to hear from you. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899. Owen Lead weighing in, saying caning is barbaric, puts Malaysia into the dark ages in the way of the world. So change the law. It's simple in his book. I don't think it's quite as simple, Owen, but tell us what you think as well on Twitter at BFM Radio is our handle. We've got the 7 o'clock news coming up after this. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.